sustainable investing, socially responsible investing, impact investing, or ESG investing all mean the same thing. But can this type of investment reap a rate of return? Could it also be a benefit to the world around us? I'm Lee Rayburn, and this hour we're taking a look at socially responsible investing, however you want to call it, sustainable finance, with our guest, Chris Merker. He's an executive in residence and co-director of the S-Lab Governance Plus Sustainability in the Department of Finance at Marquette University. He's the director of Baird Private Asset Management. He publishes the blog Sustainable Finance and is co-author of the book The Trustee Governance Guide, The Five Imperatives of 21st Century Investing. And if you have questions about where to put your money, where it can reap a rate of return that may go beyond just dollar signs, you are certainly welcome to join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. And Chris, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Lee. Nice to be here. Appreciate it.
Let's start with just some basic definitions here. What are we talking about when we're talking about ESG investments?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think there's a lot of, frankly, kind of misunderstandings that people have about the difference between impact investments or ESG investments or socially responsible investments. In fact, one of the challenges over the last several years has been it's a bit of an alphabet soup, especially when you start bringing in sustainability frameworks into the picture. So I would kind of think about it maybe in kind of two ways, and then kind of spread it across, sort of the level of involvement that an investor might have. But on the one hand, there is sort of risk managed investments where people are interested in making sure that risks that may affect the financial outlook for a particular investment, be it climate risk or other types of risk, you know, the license to operate for a business, that those are risk managed. And I would say that's kind of mainstream today, how investment managers will consider many different facets of the types of investments they're making on behalf of individuals or, you know, 401k plans or whatever. And then there's the more social impact type investments where an investor is looking for a particular outcome for that investment other than a financial. It could be extra financial in that sense. And so that's where you kind of have the two poles, and then there's some variation in between.
So ESG stands for environment, social, and governance when it comes to investments. And the way you lay out the picture, there's risk managed investments that look at things like climate, maybe not just the temperature of the planet, but also the political climate, and then social impact, where you'd want your money to do some good. And that may not necessarily mean that you are looking for the largest rate of return.
Yeah, that's a good way to think about it. Although I'd think about it, maybe I'd adjust that a little bit, because the political aspect of what you just said has been more of a factor in recent years. In the past, we looked at it more as regulatory, where a business could if they present a specific risk, think about trains derailing. That's obviously a risk that brings in regulatory scrutiny. What's also affected, I would say, ESG investing in recent years has been some of the political controversy around ESG, which we really didn't see prior to 2021. It was more of a separate kind of conversation. And so that's sort of new with what's been happening in what I would describe as the area of sustainable investing.
Saw this story from the Wall Street Journal just a month ago, and the headline is The State of ESG Investing, and it specifically mentions the Trump administration's positions against climate change measures and workforce diversity, and how that may have contributed to a retreat from ESG advocacy by some of the biggest institutional investors. What's your reaction to that, Chris?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely been become a different political environment for ESG investors. I guess, the core principle that I would sort of use to frame that is that investors really shouldn't should neither impose an unrelated political agenda through the portfolio nor ignore financially relevant risks because those risks have become politically controversial. So I think that's been sort of the unfortunate sort of context in the last few years is even before the Trump administration, there was a fair amount of political ideology that was entering into that sustainability conversation. I think some people kind of questioned, is this necessarily working for my investments? Is this necessarily appropriate? And we saw a reaction in that in the United States, especially. And so we've kind of seen the pendulum swing the other direction too now. So both sides. For me, it's all about. It's all about serving investors. It's all about fiduciary duty and stewardship. It's all about understanding risks. And so I think, that's been an unfortunate part of the conversation, but I think there is some good news around that. And I'm happy to talk more as we go here in the conversation.
Yeah. What do you see as the good news? And in the bigger picture, the current state of ethical and sustainable investing, Chris?
Well, I think part of it, this has been a development that goes back a long time. I mean, we could go back to the 1920s or even before with faith-based investing to talk about how, based on more of a, sort of a moral history or tradition, people of all different sets of beliefs approached investments. And that, has carried forward into the recent world. A lot of the sort of faith-based informed it in the early 1970s when we saw more of an environmental consciousness arise. And then we saw, throughout the 1970s and 1980s, even some divestment movements that became particularly successful, especially around apartheid in South Africa. And so those were, a combination of sort of divestment campaigns, faith-based campaigns, consumer boycotts. And then where we saw it really become more of a corporate type context has been sort of in the 1990s on with the development of corporate governance practice and theory. And that's really where my research has focused in the last several years at Marquette is, it's why we call it the lab, the S-Lab, Governance Plus Sustainability. Really, the governance side of things is how, we sort of balance the risks in the world and make decisions, as whether it's, governments or companies or nonprofit organizations. So I think the good news on that, just to make a long story short, is that these things have been developing a long time. These practices have been coming through a long time. And so whether we're talking about investment managers and how they integrate ESG factors into their investment decision-making processes, or we're talking about corporate sustainability, even though the label and the branding, which we heard about so much in recent years, has receded, those practices are now pretty mainstream today. So that's where I would say there is some good news.
I appreciate the historical perspective. I guess I hadn't thought about it going back 100+ years now and how it's always been at least part of an investment strategy. Chris Merker is our guest from the, as mentioned, S-Lab Governance Plus Sustainability in lab in the Department of Finance at Marquette University, also with Baird Private Asset Management. We invite you to the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. About sustainable finance. He also writes the blog called The Same. You can email us, talk@wpr.org, as Stephen Oshkosh did. Stephen Oshkosh emailed to say Norway's sovereign wealth fund seems to be an outstanding example of successful ethical investing, but it's only for Norwegian citizens. Chris, is there any fund that copies or models itself on the portfolio of that fund which Americans could invest in?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, especially coming from Norway, which, of course, their economy is dependent on fossil fuels. they have significant oil and gas industry, and that's created a significant amount of wealth for that country, which, of course, has led to its sovereign wealth fund. The sovereign wealth fund is an interesting example of how much can you do when you have trillions of dollars to manage. It's actually been quite a challenge for the Norwegian Sovereign Wealth Fund over the years because when you have that much money to move around, where do you go and how do you do it? And I actually think as smaller investment pools or even individuals, you can be a lot more nimble and a lot more selective in terms of how you invest. So I would say actually Norway has done a great job, obviously, but they've had some kind of limitations because of their sheer scale of what they manage.
So you make a case that smaller may be better, when it always, at least from the outside looking in, you can get the impression that the larger it is, the more sway it has.
Certainly in the area of impact investing, we're talking about investors working on projects that have a direct outcome, whether it's into a new technology, if we're talking, venture capital or private equity. That's where, if you're an investor and you're looking to move the needle on some sustainability issue, you know, a lot of it's happening in technology and innovation today, and that's where, you know, you can be very, very selective about where you target your investment.
When it comes to technology, there are issues that come to the fore that would be artificial intelligence, the need for data centers, their reliance on increased electricity. We talked last week about a Public Service Commission draft report that found Wisconsin's energy demand could go up by 40% in the next 6 years, largely because of new data centers coming to the state. And the water use, which remains an open question, and how much that may need to be used. How do you factor all this in when you look at what is driving the market right now seems to be those sort of AI tech companies, Chris?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question, especially with how much artificial intelligence is transforming the economy and the markets. You're right; it's presented some questions, I think, for consumers, for investors, especially around the energy intensity of the technologies, the energy demands for the foreseeable future, and of course some of the water impacts or questions around that. And I would say, you know, there's a couple of things I think people are right to certainly be aware, especially as it affects, you know, places like Wisconsin, where we're seeing, you know, significant build-out in AI data centers. On the other hand, I do think there's also some misunderstanding as to how these bottlenecks or risks are being managed. For example, a lot of investment is happening directly in contracts with energy provision. So as hyperscalers are coming in and investing in local communities, they're also generally on the hook for securing their own contracts and energy sources to support the data center. And there's, I think, very clear awareness that if people start to be adversely affected in their communities, that there will be pushback and blowback. They just had the CEO of Brookfield Asset Management on CNBC interviewed yesterday talking about one of their investments in data centers, and he was very clear on that actually we should see a lot of build-out in the electricity and energy systems in the coming years that will benefit consumers. So I think that there's a fair amount of perhaps misunderstanding around that.
Mm-hmm.
On the issue of water, I do think that there's some risk there, especially in areas that are water stressed. You know, you think about southwestern United States. Around here, though, you know, we, of course, are quite rich in water resources, quite unusually, as you look across the world. And here it's less of an issue because we do have these significant resources in the area of water. But, also how that's handled, how it's used for cooling, how it's being, put back in the water systems, I think all of that is generally in place. And so I'm less concerned on these issues as I learn more about what's been happening in these big build out of these data facilities.
What about concerns over an economic bubble, the idea that AI may be overinflated right now in these markets?
Yeah, that's a question that comes up relatively often, especially, you know, talking with clients. A lot of people kind of think back and around the time my career started in finance was, of course, around the dot-com bubble.
Yeah.
And that, you know, I think for anybody who's old enough to remember that period, there's some echoes in today's world where you think, oh, you know, are we setting ourselves up for something similar? You know, I think there's a lot of differences certainly between now and then. You know, the investment is happening by companies that are, frankly, you know, well-positioned leaders in their respective industries. We've seen, you know, generally the markets have appeared to be somewhat rational. I mean, even, you know, if you look at semiconductors earlier in the year, that area got certainly overbought, but has corrected quite clearly. And for the hyperscalers themselves, you know, investors have had questions, well, at what point does this start to turn a profit, and what will that look like? And so those names have, you know, investors haven't really been chasing. Where we've been seeing the benefit is actually across other sectors in the economy. So what people don't necessarily think about is, you know, how much stuff goes into the AI build-out. This is the largest infrastructure project ever taken, not just in the United States history, in world history. I mean, we can go back to the development of fiber during the internet, the highway system, the railroads. Nothing even comes close. I mean, what's been invested, you know, what was invested in 2025 is roughly $500 billion. This year, it's going to be another three quarters of a trillion. Over the next 2 years, possibly another $2 trillion. There is significant investment happening, capital investment that is, for now, benefiting all parts of the economy. I think the long-term question really has to do with, and we, of course, could do a whole separate radio segment on artificial intelligence. I won't go there. I think the long-term question is, what kind of productivity benefits do we receive? And, of course, that's an important sustainability question for the economy long-term with all these significant investments happening.
Because these AI companies haven't necessarily turned a profit yet, but you talk about it in terms of not these companies alone, but the largest infrastructure project in world history that is building up around these companies.
Well, to be clear, I mean, these companies are extremely profitable. They generate tons of cash.
I was thinking of like OpenAI. They haven't turned a profit, have they?
Yeah, I see. You're not talking hyperscalers. You're talking about some of the AI, the pure play AI companies.
Sure. What do you mean by hyperscalers then, Chris?
Oh, hyperscalers would include, you know, the Microsoft, okay, the Googles, the Amazon,
Nvidia.
The ones that are Nvidia, you know, Nvidia is more focused specifically on the chips. It's more the people that are, you know, owning the data centers, which are, you know, that have the platforms, Google, Amazon, and Microsoft specifically, and Oracle. Include those, that company in that category as well. So, you know, you've got different companies within that value chain. You've got the AI software provider, the model, you know, the generative models. Then you have the data center owners, and then you know within that you've got all the providers and suppliers that sort of support this whole ecosystem developing around us.
Then is it possible to effectively invest without finding your money in one of these AI avenues? If you are upset at data centers coming to your community, if you are concerned about their energy usage, if you have questions about their long-term viability, are there still investment moves you can make that would find a rate of return that would avoid this AI integration?
You mean avoid the investment,
yeah,
out of concern for how they will perform in the future? Is that what you're asking?
How they perform or their impact?
Well, I think, you know, the first question you have to answer is, will the impact be good or bad? And I'd say right now, the build-out itself has been very positive. I mean, it's been driving economic growth. It's been spreading into other sectors. You know, it's driving real estate, materials, industrials. You know, that part of it, the infrastructure build-out itself has been very positive. You know, as far as the long term, you know, depending on who you talk to, this could be a significant support for economic development well into the future. I mean, you know, especially as we look at sort of demographic shifts, you know, we've got declining demographics, questions around, you know, long-term labor market support, not just here in the United States, but across the world, even in, you know, emerging markets, places that typically had very strong demographics. And so, you know, I'd say there's a, depending on who you talk to, there's either a very rosy view of the picture or there's a very grim view of the picture of the future. And so what I would tell investors is, you know, you need to spread your bets like everything else.
Right.
You know, we not knowing, none of us are fortune tellers. So you've got to, you know, I certainly believe in, you know, if I wouldn't work in the financial markets as I do, if I didn't have a strong belief in human innovation and prospects for future success for investors. And so I remain very generally constructive in my outlooks. But if we wanted to talk more specifically about risks and, you know, how you can sort of adjust your portfolio, or if you have concerns, you know, how does that meet your values,
yeah,
can always talk about, because that's what we do every day, is try to balance those viewpoints amongst our clients.
You said earlier that governance is how we balance the risks, and ESG includes governance as part of investment. And when I think of corporate governance, I think of the questions that have been raised between what the corporate executives get paid versus what their lowest workers get paid. You mentioned Amazon. There's other companies as well where the you know, corporate compensation seems to be through the roof compared to folks who are working for these companies. Is that taken into a consideration, or is that just part of what's baked into our these corporations today, Chris, as you see it?
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting question that has been on people's minds, I think, for a long time, executive compensation. There's been, of course, you know, steps taken by the SEC to provide greater transparency around that, you know, say on pay rules and producing sort of that median, you know, average worker to CEO comp. And so, you know, that all that is kind of out there, and you know, certainly shareholders have the ability to vote with their feet or their votes, or you know, certainly investors. But in general, the trend has been you know, sort of greater compensation. I mean, that's, you know, that's just been whether we're talking about CEOs in this country or NBA basketball players. So you know, it's now, you know, at the same time, I think it's important for people to understand that it's not just CEOs that have gotten wealthier. It's also all of us as investors. I mean, the wealth in this country, the wealth creation that continues is significant. And in that respect, you know, the U.S. even stands apart from the world with its level of technology and innovation. So, you know, it's great. I mean, you're reading at the same time a lot of stories in the paper about 401k millionaires and the sort of wealth effect in this country, and albeit not equally shared or distributed, and that's been certainly an issue, I think, post-COVID with the K-shaped economy that we find ourselves in. But
sure.
In general, there's been just unbelievable wealth creation happening here in the United States.
For investors, but the question was more about the workers, and the idea would then be to have the workers make enough money to be able to invest, which is the opportunity for retirement. And then for those who are just getting by or scraping by, wonder what, you know, what they could possibly do or what avenues they have ahead to look forward to or find a means to be able to invest. But some of the investment strategies I've seen, Chris, have to do with finding a way, no matter what, to squirrel a little bit away every paycheck, because investment is ultimately how you're going to get ahead in this economy, as opposed to sweat equity.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And that's why I mentioned the 401k program, mm-hmm, specifically, because I think that's such an important element to wealth creation. That's why, you know, for anyone, you want to you want to participate where you can, if your employer, and hopefully, you know, the listeners today have access to 401k programs, and you know, they can benefit from employee matches. But yeah, this has definitely been an issue we've looked at in the lab. Part of my PhD research was in the area of retirement security and looking at how pension funds are managed, you know, state pension funds, as well as, you know, private funds. And so, you know, retirement security is extremely important. And, you know, savings rates in this country have been, you know, not where they should, no doubt.
Chris, let's put a pin in this and get back to it in just a couple of minutes, because it is an interesting discussion. And the question, because I do see the stories about the lack of investing in retirement, and I do hear from you the need for it. Chris Merker, our guest, he publishes the blog Sustainable Finance, Executive in Residence at the S Lab, Governance Plus Sustainability at Marquette University. We'll continue next on WPR News. How can you avoid the retirement scare? How can you find enough money to squirrel away to find a way to enjoy the fruits of your labors after your labors are over? We're talking about sustainable investment this hour with our guest Chris Merker on The Lee Rayburn Show, and you're invited to the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. Whether it's faith-based investing, impact investing, values-based investing, ESG investing, that stands for environment, social, and governance investing. Where can you put your money where your mouth is? 1-800-642-1234 or email talk@wpr.org. Chris Merker is executive in residence and co-director at the S Lab, Governance Plus Sustainability at the Department of Finance in Marquette University. Also the director of Baird Private Asset Management, publishes the blog Sustainable Finance, and is co-author of the book The Trustee Governance Guide, The Five Imperatives of 21st Century Investing. Chris, do you see a retirement crisis on the horizon? Is this a red flag for folks who look at investments like you?
Yes. I mean, the retirement crisis is one of those things that has been foretold for decades. we've understood the long-term risks. The fewer workers that are, contributing to our Social Security systems, and what will Social Security be around, and what year will the trust fund be depleted, and on and on. And we could sort of parlay that into the federal debt and our growing burdens with our entitlement systems. So yes, it is a problem. No doubt. But I think there's hope. And I think you are seeing, like I said, compared to other countries, the United States continues to really outperform in the sense that, we continue to grow our economy and we continue to create wealth in this nation. But that can't necessarily go on forever. And we also have to contribute. We have to pay into our systems, and we have to save money for ourselves. And so that these are all very important questions facing every single one of us. And I don't care what age you are. That's preparing for retirement, for education, whatever personal goals you have. These are things that I talk about every day with people because they're extremely important.
So no matter who you are, no matter what you make, you have to at least find a way into an investment if you are going to have a hope of retirement?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. One of the things that I've been involved with for a number of years here in Milwaukee is Secure Futures, which is a financial literacy nonprofit organization that provides financial literacy training to hundreds and hundreds of high schools throughout the region, and has been doing this. I think this is their 20th year. And so one of the things I teach is Money Path and helping people understand how to pursue education and finance their education, leverage that educational investment into future savings and, pursuing their personal goals of owning a home someday or, pursuing that graduate degree or, whatever it is, right, saving for retirement. These are all things I think at a very fundamental level we all need to have a better understanding and education about financial literacy. So I think that's a big step in all of this.
And from my perspective, part of this has to do with trusting the market and whether or not you trust the market. And I feel like you have to buy into the trust at some level in order to benefit from it. But Do you have any suggestions as to how to build your own trust in this system?
Yeah, so part of the reason that I became interested in sustainability as a field really goes back to my experience as an MBA student in the late 90s, the world that we were kind of living through at that time. We had sort of financial crises happening around the globe, but at the same time we were seeing a technology boom here in the United States. And then suddenly, as we got into the early 2000s, we saw the aftermath. You know, we saw accounting scandals happening with companies. And, then a few years later, we had the global financial crisis. And so part of my question was, what's going on with our system?
Yeah.
it was kind of a lot over that decade. And, I will say, and this is where I think, pursuing certainly as investors, as members of this country, and our civilization more broadly, this is why governance is so important. And I do think, we have seen some significant reforms happen in this country. We haven't had major accounting scandals in quite a long time. So some of the effects of Sarbanes-Oxley, I think, were positive.
Okay.
Now there were some negative effects of that. It made fewer public companies. So, and you always to broaden investment and ensure participation amongst the widest group of potential investors, you want public equities to be available to the general public. But I think our corporate governance systems have been strengthened. And I do think post-GFC, our banking system has generally been strengthened. But this was not easy, and it required a lot of action by our government with some changes in the regulatory structure to make those adjustments. But your point is very well made, and this is what I teach in my class at Marquette, which starts up in a few weeks. Trust is the cornerstone of investing, and certainly an important without it, we can't have a sustainable society. So very, very important.
Chris, you mentioned post-GFC earlier. What's that?
Oh, I'm sorry. Global financial crisis.
Okay.
2008.
Oh, I remember that. Yeah, you've got an acronym for it because everybody knows post GFC. Yeah, that was a global financial crisis indeed. And did we come out better for that in terms of governance, in your opinion, Chris?
So I would say from the standpoint of our banking system, yes.
Okay.
We had a little. Little taste of that back in 2022 when we went through the interest rate shock that year. That was after the inflation scare of the COVID period.
Yeah.
When the Fed raised rates faster than they had in history. And that effectively brought about the demise of two of the top 10 banks in the United States. It also drove a merger of a major Swiss bank. And at that point, that could have easily spiraled into another banking crisis. And because the Fed had its powers that it does post global financial crisis and a playbook and the experience, that crisis was effectively stemmed. So I'd say, we did go through a recent stress test on that. And, that's a good thing. Now, I think that there's some questions and, this is what the new Fed is, of course, grappling with, what does the Fed in the future look like, and what is its role, and does it have to carry this enormous balance sheet and be as interventionist in the market, and sort of the questions around the sort of active Fed we've seen over the past decade plus. But in general, to answer your question about is it better, I would say yeah. I mean, we haven't had a major crisis since 2008, certainly of that scale.
Yeah, the GFC. I will not forget that now. Let's go to your questions for our guest, Chris Merker, from the S-Lab Governance Plus Sustainability in the Department of Finance at Marquette University, also with Baird Private Asset Management. You can join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. Let's go to Alan in Verona now. Hi, Alan.
Hi there. Hey, I had a question or try to get some input on how you know, people in, that are investing either in stocks or mutual funds, are people for fear, like you had just talked about the trust in the system, out of fear, are people looking to pull profits that are being made out to have more of a cash balance, maybe leaving initial investments in place, but taking some of those profits out as a cash, you know, mm-hmm. to paying taxes. And I'm just kind of curious because it's, you know, with the rise in the stock market, everybody that has mutual funds, stocks, they're just going through the roof. What's the consensus on the downside of that? You know, when the things start coming down, is there more value in just having a cash fund?
Alan, it's a good question. Now, our guest can't give any specific financial advice, but markets are cyclical, right, Chris? But it doesn't feel mm-hmm. like that recently. It feels like market goes up, market goes up, and market goes up.
Yeah, I mean, like you said, I can't give you any specific advice, you know, other than, you know, follow your plan. You know, hopefully you're working with a financial advisor, and you know, they're helping you sort of combine your values, objective, and tolerance for risk, and you know, understanding that you know, markets of course come and go, and you know, whether it's cash, bonds, equities, you know, you should always be thinking about, you know, not owning too much of one thing, not putting all your eggs in one basket. So hopefully you're diversifying, rebalancing, and doing all the things that are prudent in terms of, you know, managing your own plan.
Alan, I thank you for the call, but having cash on hand, is that a savvy investment or just a safe place? Or neither?
You asking me or
Chris? Go. What does cash look like in terms of investment strategy?
Yeah. So I'll tell you, cash today is a lot better than it was 10 years ago.
Okay.
You know, you can get you know, either through a high yielding money market or you know, through a bank. You know, you can be earning higher yield than you certainly were back then, 10 years ago, when we saw rock bottom interest rates. You know, the only thing to keep in mind with cash is that you've got to think about inflation.
Yep.
And you know, the inflation rate in this country right now has been running a little bit hotter this year, as we've been seeing some of the effects on you know, some Middle East action that's ongoing, and the effect on oil prices and other things of that nature. And so, you know, that's part of the question, is what does the inflation look like long term? That's something that the Fed's continuing to grapple with. And that's where, you know, it can affect the value of your money over time, which is why I think people tend to, you know, the successful investors tend to look at this long term. But, you know, you've got to balance your liquidity needs at the same time. And that's why, you know, that's a balancing act that all of us as investors have to follow. And you know, what are the right amounts of cash to have, and what are the right amounts of investments? And that's why it's important that, you know, you seek professional advice where you can.
Alan, thank you for the call. Chris, a little bit more on some of the practical guidance for folks who are looking to incorporate things like ethical considerations into their investments and the trust in the market and the fact that we all want to have the opportunity to retire someday.
Yeah, so maybe I'll take that in kind of three parts.
Sure.
On the ethical side of investing, I would say there's never been a better time for investors to certainly find options in the market to express those values. You know, if we go back, dial back the clock a couple of years, I mean, there were so many, you know, quote-unquote ESG products that were being launched, and that's where, you know, some of the concern happened with, you know, what does this actually mean? And, you know, what is this greenwashing? Is it real?
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I think that time has passed. And so, you know, there are some very a large number of offerings in the market today that take, you know, either low-cost approaches with screening investments, or you know, hire an active manager who you know has a developed team to help pick certain investments to support whatever goal. And it depends. I mean, every investor is different. as far as what they're looking to do. I think there's a lot out there, and so it's a matter of just figuring out what your values are, what are your goals, and finding the right sort of combination for that. As far as the rest of it goes, planning for retirement, saving, investing, concern about sort of good markets and bad markets, which we'll always have. I think the main thing for people investing today, which has been sort of good advice as far back as I can remember, and that is just being disciplined, following a plan, being consistent, not making, knee-jerk decisions. I look at, sort of the last 5 years of our investing arena, and it's been quite tumultuous, between, to say the least, between what's happening in the Middle East or here at home, and geopolitics and, innovation. It's been an uncertain time, but at the same time, it's been rewarding, but rewarding to those who stick with a plan and stay disciplined. And so that's where I think everyone needs to really take a look at that and really stick with a long-term plan.
So that seems to make a case against day traders or people who would enter into an app to buy a stock for a day and then look for a quick sell. From the position of the Governance Plus Sustainability S-Lab at Marquette University, is it really sustainable to be a day trader? Is that something? And it also seems to argue against what you were just talking about with finding a plan and sticking to it. Or could that be a plan?
Yeah, this has been the era of the meme stock, something we never heard about.
Could you explain
ago.
The meme stock? Because I'm not even sure I understand it, other than what is it, GameStop? Or was that the?
Yeah, I mean, it's been a number of stocks where suddenly they get talked about in social media, and there's a following around that, and when you kind of peel back the onion and look at the company in question, whether it's the one you mentioned or any number of other ones that kind of come and go, you sort of look at it on the basis of the fundamentals and you scratch your head and go, I'm not sure I understand why this company is now worth four times what it was a month ago. I think that, some people have fun with investing, as long as they understand that, there's a role for long-term investing, and there's a role for going to the casino, that's an important distinction to make.
So the day trading you would see more as a slot machine as opposed to a sound financial investment strategy.
I think I can say that safely.
That makes some sense to me. But I guess I'm always apprehensive because once I've earned it, I want to hold on to it. But holding on to it's not going to benefit you in the long run. The benefit is finding a place to put it that mirrors or that you can support and doesn't seem to violate your values. And then you'll be able to find a return on that investment somewhere down the road. I feel like that makes a lot of sense, but what's the disconnect as far as you see, Chris, when it comes to folks being reluctant to invest in retirement and investment strategies?
I think we do tend to have a long-term investing community, whether, we read about it in the headlines or hear about it on the radio. 401ks, for example, are a significant form of savings here in the United States.
Yes.
And I can't tell you the percentages, but it's in the trillions of dollars. Can you day trade your 401k? Sure. Do people do it? I'm sure they do. But in general, I'd say most people are too busy raising their families or working or doing whatever they have to in their daily life to be day trading their long-term retirement savings accounts. So I'd say for the most part, the average household is not day trading.
Right.
But that's not fun to read about. So you're not going to read about a boring, I did nothing on my account today. So that's, I think that's what's actually happening. And I think it is creating generally long-term consistent results for people as they look to the future. And, we've got a big wave of baby boomers that are passing through right now that are, they've been retiring for several years now. They've done quite well,
yeah.
in the markets over the past, 40 years. And, the next could be said true of this next generation. So, but it's a matter of having that culture, doing it early. I advise young people as soon as you can start investing, because as Einstein said, compound returns is the strongest force in the universe. And time is your ally. Time is an asset, and so these are the things that you really want to focus your energy and time on, because they will bear fruit eventually. So,
Chris, you want to talk a little bit about how shareholder engagement is changing, what we're seeing in terms of, you mentioned 401k, I feel like that doesn't give the person any sort of, that doesn't give the individual investor the sort of shareholder engagement. It gives the fund the engagement there. But what does that mean in terms of investments?
Yeah, so that's an interesting area. And if you talk to a corporate governance scholar, a lot of the answer, especially from what I understand in some of the corporate governance in the law schools for the last couple of decades, the answer was always proxy access. Access to the ballot,
mm-hmm.
Which is a very esoteric and maybe to some sort of confusing, like, oh, we vote in political elections. Does that we vote also on stocks? Yes, there's a whole voting thing that happens with corporate stocks. In recent years, there's been a lot of talk around it, proxy activism. That certainly has fallen off in the last couple of years with kind of the political backlash we talked about earlier in this conversation. So, I would almost dare to say that the time of the proxy voting activity or stewardship activism, however you want to name it, I won't say it's completely disappeared, but it has definitely fallen off. You're not seeing the proposals that you were a couple of years ago. You're not seeing the votes. And frankly, about a third of them are anti-ESG, quote unquote.
Huh.
So you're actually seeing a lot of anti-ESG proposals that have come up. So, the proxy remains kind of a battleground amongst certain types of investors. I don't think it really necessarily affects what most of us in our daily lives are doing or living through. Generally, the effects on corporate policy or action, I think, is at this point kind of speculative at best. I don't think it is really changing what we're seeing in more of the trends around corporate sustainability and what companies are doing as part of, managing their bottom line. So, that's kind of a long-winded answer to say, yes, it's there. We were hearing a lot more about it a couple of years ago, and
right.
Now we're hearing a lot less about it.
Got about a minute and a half here, Chris, but just to sort of summarize the hour, which I really very much appreciate, I've enjoyed and understood. Do investors need to sacrifice financial returns to find some alignment with their portfolios and their values?
Well, I think the honest answer is there's always going to be trade-offs.
Okay.
Every investment has some consideration or, effect, positive or negative, on in our world, on the economy. I would say that, it's a balancing act, whether we're talking about individuals or we're talking about companies or we're talking about boards of institutional investors. And so that's the balance that, we as, sort of fiduciaries, stewards, agents within the sort of milieu of investing have to balance. But I do think that's where the progress in our world will continue, whether it's taking on sustainability challenges, developing strategies around resilience, making our world greener,
yeah.
Richer. Kind of what we want for this generation and the next. I think that's going to continue to be a tense point. But, as I mentioned earlier, I feel optimistic.
Chris, thanks so much for joining us this hour. Really appreciate it, and I look forward to catching up with you again.
Thank you. you. Really appreciate spending time with you today, Lee.
Chris Merker is executive in residence and co-director of the S-Lab, Governance Plus Sustainability in the Department of Finance at Marquette University. He's director of Baird Private Asset Management. He publishes the blog Sustainable Finance and is the co-author of the book, The Trustee Governance Guide, The Five Imperatives of 21st Century Investing. Also want to remind you that next Monday, this show will be live from the Grand Champion Hall at the Wisconsin State Fair in West Allis. Hope to see you there. You can get details online at wpr.org/presents. All you need is a ticket for the state fair in order to enter. We'll be live from 11 to 1, and I hope to see you there. We'll be celebrating our agriculture, highlighting the competitions, talking to special guests, and hopefully you as well. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you are listening to WPR News.